Support for Sound
One of the great things about being out on a hike is having plenty of space, especially if the world keeps telling you you're too big.
What are these fat girls doing hiking, you know? We were just like laughing about it, like, yeah, we're fat girls and we're hiking.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, personal space. We'll meet a gay man defiantly carving out space for himself in the country music world. When, to his shock, a record label called.
And I just hung up on them because I knew it was an encyclopedia salesman because nobody was going to be buying Love Your Country.
Plus, an act of compassion in maybe the most personal space of all.
It always feels like such a privilege to be invited in. It just feels like such sacred space for those few minutes.
That's all ahead on Sound Effect from 88.5. Your weekly tour of ideas inspired by the place
you live. I'm Jennifer Wing.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
And this is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. And we should tell people where we are and what we're up to.
The news is next.
Right. Okay. So we went to this little place in the Lake City neighborhood of Seattle called Rage Industries. It's a little building. You go inside, you pay some money, and then you walk up to what looks like a big overstocked bar, and you pick out like a milk crate's worth of breakables. And then you take them into this little room and close the door and you smash them.
Ready?
Cool. And why are we smashing things?
Oh, because it feels so good.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
So, Gabe, are you channeling anything? Has this touched any nerve?
Yes. I definitely do have some. I don't know if I'd call it rage, but some energy that I don't have a good outlet for. That I can feel. Oozing out at the moment. A lot of it is wrapped up with frustration with my children. But I don't know if that should go on the radio or not, but when I'm trying to get them out the door in the morning, it's just maddening. And, you know, you gotta remain calm, right? So maybe I should just come here every morning and reenact it. I'll just be like, get your shoes on! Oh, that helps a lot. You should try that.
The shoes, the brushing of the teeth, the jacket.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That was awesome. That's good stuff. So the thing is, like, we all have the urge to break stuff, right? I mean, I think what human doesn't have images in their head of just smashing, but it's not something you would really want to do in your house or your office. You know, you don't want to do this in your own personal space. So it's kind of awesome to be able to do this very, I don't know, in a way it's a weird private thing, but to have a place to go. And, you know, that's our show today. Today on Sound Effect, personal space, we're going to have stories of people like encroaching on your space, getting up in your grill, and also carving out a personal space even when society does not want to let you. It's all coming up on Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. Stick around. Whoops.
We're about to meet a guy who spent decades carving out some space for himself in a society that didn't seem to have any room for him. Patrick Haggerty is a gay man in his 70s, and one of the ways that he looked to claim that space was through music, country music. In the early 70s, as the gay liberation movement was taking shape, Haggerty and his pals cut an album in Seattle. It was called Lavender Country, and it's thought to be the world's first openly gay country album. He says it was provocative, but also good music,
And still, he didn't think that much would come of it.
It was hopeless to even consider anything like gay country in 1973. And besides, it was unabashedly radical. And so, other than have a good time with it ourselves, it had to die, and did.
Why country music?
There's two answers to that. One, why not? It's authentic, it's from the heart, it's American, it's familiar to a lot of people. Just because you're gay doesn't mean you can't be country. So that's the short answer. Buzz off, why not country? As good as any other genre. The second answer is, I'm not a seasoned, trained, go-to-college musician. I grew up at the mouth of the Owa River, west of Port Angeles. I'm a down-home dirt boy from a sharecropping, dairy farming family. And I did Lavender Country and chose that genre because it was the only kind of music I knew how to do.
Could you talk about some of the songs that were on the original album and what the inspirations were?
Back in the Closet Again is a song about how we as homosexuals had to kick our way into the labor movement, the women's movement, the movement for human rights and civil rights. And that we were unable to unite as a working class, and therefore the capitalists won.
Oh, I have to be alone because I'm sitting all alone back in the closet again.
Come Out Singing is just a gay liberation song about the joy of gay sex.
Waking up to say hip hip hooray, I'm glad I'm gay.
How was it received?
It put a scarlet letter on my chest. We knew that gay music in general was not going to be taken seriously by anybody except us. And I'd never sing in Nashville in this life. That turned out not to be true.
What gave you the courage to do something this new?
It came from my father. That's a whole big well.
Could we dip a bucket in that well?
We could. I don't believe in God, and I'm not much into religion, but something in the universe bestowed on me an absolutely ballerina, perfect, magnificent father for who I was and where I was headed. And he was disguised as a snuff-chewing, Farmer Brown pants-wearing, country bumpkin hayseed. My father saw who he had on his hands at a very early age, like 5. And in his mind, I was the child that God gave him to love. And by damn, he was going to do it some kind of way, because that was his job. And the way he taught me to take pride in myself was that he took pride in me. That's how that job is done. That wasn't an easy job for a kid who wore ballerina outfits at the 4-H camp and went to the Catholic Youth Organization talent shows in full drag. All kinds of things. I could sit in here and talk to you all day about what my dad said I could do, and I did, with impunity and glee and aplomb, my entire childhood. My father taught me to hold my head in dignity and go forth into the world with candor and forthrightness.
Do you remember how that came across to you? How how that guidance came down to you as a kid?
One of the things that my dad said I had to do was win some scholarships so that I could get the hell up out of the valley because I was never going to make it as a farmer. And it was a very serious job. Go get the job done. One of the things that you did to win a scholarship was run for student body office. And so I decided to run for pep promoter, which is essentially the head cheerleader. And I was on my way to school, and I was putting on my costume for the pep assembly, which consisted of a big lipstick smile from ear to ear, huge, several inches thick, with glitter all over my face. My brother was driving me to school. He said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting on my costume." He was horrified. He called my father. He said, "You got to get up there. They're going to kill him. Go to the high school now." So I'm doing my campaign and running with the socialites, and here comes my father. And my father is wearing his clodhopper boots and his Farmer Brown pants with cow crop on them, and he's missing half of his teeth, and he looks like Pa Kettle, and I love him, and he's my dad, but I don't need Pa Kettle raining on my parade. So I ducked him. I ducked him. So we had the assembly, and blah, 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 and I did my little spiel, and things are going great. So I'm riding home. My dad is taking me home because I have to start pitching bales. And he said, "I thought I saw a kid look just like you duck out on his dad when I walked down the hall this morning, but I knew it wasn't you because you'd never do that to your dad." And I said, "Dad, did you have to wear your cow crap pants to my pep assembly?" And he said, "Oh, I see. This isn't about what you were wearing. It's about what I was wearing. I get it. Look here, I'm a farmer. This is what I do. I don't have time to change my clothes just to run up to the high school to see what the hell is going on with you. I'm proud of who I am, and I'm proud of what I do. This is what I wear. Now let's talk about you. Were you proud of yourself with your lipstick smile and glitter on your face, all up and down to your ears? Were you proud of yourself?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to win the election." And he said, "I think you're going to win the election too, but it's not what I asked you. I asked you if you were proud of yourself." At this point, I'm not saying anything. And he said, "You know I'm not well." I said, "Yes, Dad, I know." He said, "You know I'm not going to be around when you're a full-grown man to help you with any of this stuff. You know that." And I said, "Yes, Dad, I know." And he said, "Well, I'm going to tell you something today, now. I'm going to tell you something now. And it might not mean anything to you now, but it will mean something when you get to be an adult. And I want you to promise me that you'll remember what I tell you." I said, "Okay, I promise." He said, "Who are you going to go out with at night when you go to the University of Washington Drama School?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "I think you do know. Now listen up. Whoever you run around with at night, don't sneak like you did today. Because if you sneak, it means you think you're doing the wrong thing. And if you spend your life thinking you're doing the wrong thing, you'll ruin your immortal soul. So don't sneak, and remember it." I ask you, man, what sissy in 1958 in what hayfield in America got that from his father? Everybody else was getting the kicked out of him, being humiliated and disgraced, thrown out of the family, being beat up by their brothers. That's what was happening to country sissies in 1958. But it wasn't happening to me because of my father. He wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't allow anybody else to do it to me, and he wouldn't allow my brothers to humiliate me, and he wouldn't humiliate me, and he taught me not to humiliate myself. I was way ahead of the curve without even knowing it. So why did I write the world's first gay country album? My dad said I could.
So it took the world a little while to catch up to your dad, it seems. Fast forwarding back up to the early 70s after Lavender Country, you talked a little bit about some of the ways that it got kind of pushed to the margins. And what was that experience like for you?
Lots of people don't get recognized for their music. And that was fine. And that was where I was when somebody put one of my songs on YouTube, the song that we won't say over the radio.
You can if you want.
Oh, good. I have a song, and the name of the song is Crying These Sucking Tears. And if any song sunk Lavender Country for 40 years, it was that one. But 40 years went by, and somebody put Second Tears on YouTube, and I didn't know it because they don't do YouTube. And somebody else heard it and said, what is this? And they went to eBay and they found an old used vinyl for sale in one of my old Lavender Countries. And they bought it and they realized what it was. And I still don't know anything. And that person took it to a label, and the label called me on the phone, and I just about hung up on them because I knew it was an encyclopedia salesman, because nobody was going to be buying Lavender Country. But it wasn't an encyclopedia salesman, and it was really a label, and they reissued Lavender Country, and my life changed really fast. There's been 3 documentaries about Lavender Country. I did 2 live ballets of Lavender Country music in San Francisco. There's a feature-length movie being made about Lavender Country right now. So it's great to have all this acknowledgement, go down in history and all that, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, okay, it's an ego trip. But I made Lavender Country as a statement in 1973 to transform society through political organizing. So now I have the opportunity and also the revolutionary obligation to use Lavender Country for what I made it for in the first place. So that's a real bottom line joy. And the other bottom line joy is that I get to take my father with me into history, and I get to acclaim his contribution to this movement.
Patrick Haggerty's father, Charles, died in 1961. Today, Haggerty lives with his husband in Bremerton. His album, Lavender Country, is archived in the Country Music Hall of Fame.
There's nothing left but holes in your weary sexist roles. Time to trade them old PJs for a goodwill negligee. Y'all come out, my dears, to Lavender Country. Y'all come out and make yourselves to home.
This is Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Personal Space. This next story is about when that space is violated and how a survivor turned the tables in an unexpected way. Please note that this story deals with sexual assault. There's nothing explicit, but it may not be appropriate for kids. It's about 10 minutes long. Erica Dudrow lives in Bellingham, and she says she was never much of a party person, but in 2014 she was dating a guy who liked to hit the bars, and she did her best to keep up. That was getting harder to do.
The partner at that time had gotten into some harder drugs, and one of them was Molly. Friday, I showed up at his house after work, And he was already there with a friend, and they were doing lines of Molly. And he gives me a capsule of it, and I ingested it. Another friend showed up, and there was talking and drinking. We decided to walk downtown to a bar. It was probably about midnight at that time. And I remember walking down the street towards the bar and being in a really good mood, thinking, you know, like I'm having a really good time and getting along with all these people, and then starting to black out. So the next thing I remember was feeling somebody's hands inside me, and just how hard it was to wake up. It felt like climbing out of black tar. And then when I finally was able to wake up, I'm in an apartment. It's not mine. I don't understand why I'm there. I look up, there's a man over at a sink with his back to me in his underwear doing his dishes. I stand up, I realize that I'm naked from the waist down, but I still have my shirts on, I still have my jacket. I always assumed that if I was attacked by a man, we would fight to the death, that I would not let myself be assaulted. It never occurred to me that I might be blacked out for most of the event. It was really hard to put it all together. And the first thing that I thought of in that moment is, where are the people that I was with what felt like a moment ago? And I said that out loud, where are my friends? And this person said, you shouldn't worry about that. You should find them in the morning. You shouldn't go anywhere right now. I started to leave. He said, hey, let me walk you down. We went and got in the elevator. He lunged forward and kissed me. I was completely just numb at that moment. I wasn't able to put anything together in that moment. And I truly had no idea where I was until I walked out of the building and saw that I was actually just across the street from the bar. And so I called my partner. I called him over and over again, and it just went to voicemail. Later on that evening, I went to his friend's house. They had a big picture window in the living room, and I saw that it was full of people. They were all watching a football game. He saw me. He got his jacket on, he came outside, and it had started to snow actually right at that moment. And so I'm standing out there in the snow, and it comes out, and it just felt so small right then and so vulnerable. I really, in that moment, felt extremely unworthy of love. And I said, I was raped last night. And he said, you weren't raped. I saw you with that guy. You wanted to go off with him. And I said, are you really telling somebody who was just raped that they weren't? And he kind of looked at me and he said, all right, come here. And he gave me a hug. And then he said, I went home with that girl that we met at the house. And I think I want to pursue a relationship with her. And I just said, okay, well, good luck. And I turned around and left. I had plans to walk on the Camino de Santiago. It's a 500-mile walk across Spain. And it's a pilgrimage that's been around for hundreds, maybe 1,000 years. It was something that I had wanted to do for a long time. And when the assault happened, it ended up being 12, maybe 13 days before I left to walk on the Camino. So about halfway through that trip, where everybody sort of starts falling apart physically, these feelings about what had happened, they were too difficult to box up. It started to become like a song that was stuck in my head. It hit me like a ton of bricks, and I ended up emotionally falling apart, crying on the side of the trail. But I kept walking, and the most important thing that happened to me after that is I started to get out of my head a little more and listening to other people's stories. And I understood that trauma is not just mine. I don't own it. There's a lot of people going through it. And at that point, I realized, wow, it takes a ton of mental strength to command your body to do this every day. And you should realize that if you can do this, you're strong. Fall of 2015, which is the following year, there's a Facebook post by Cordelia referencing a Reddit thread where they were talking about good places to eat in Bellingham, and somebody suggested Cosmos Bistro. She said, you know, the co-owner Jameson Rogayan is a known rapist. I commented, this person raped me, and gave a brief overview of what had happened. And I guess that some other people had reached out too because of that thread. And she immediately set up a closed Facebook group. And word started to get around, and it turned out that there were a lot of women who had been sexually assaulted by him over the years. So we went to the police and we gave statements, and he was arrested after that. The trial was very hard because the defense definitely tried to portray me as an irresponsible drug addict. I felt more like someone who's trying to defend themselves and tell their side of the story. They kept telling us it was a slam dunk. He was definitely going to be convicted, and he wasn't. It was a mistrial. You only need one person on a jury who's not convinced. They chose to let him do a plea deal. They did not want to retry him because of all of the logistics of doing it the first time. And they didn't want to put us through it again. The positive thing that came out of it was being asked to deliver a victim statement at his sentencing, because that was really the only first time and last time that we were asked to just say what we wanted to say to him. I wanted to reach out and talk to him as a human. One of the reasons is that on the Camino, I realized that everyone's been through trauma, even people who inflict trauma. The most important thing to me ultimately throughout this entire thing was to stop the cycle of what he was doing, to keep him from raping other people. Hello, I would like to address the court today about my rape at the hands of Jameson Rogayan. I would like to address Jameson first. Jameson, I know that you don't think that you did anything wrong. I could see in the way you lied about your version of events that you were more. I know the complicated abuse and exploitation of women that you perpetrated does not exist in a vacuum. Somewhere along the way, someone made you feel wrong or hurt you or abused you in some way. You are a broken person, and now we're both broken. All I wanted you. When you're ready, I would be willing to start a dialogue with you. I would like to listen to what has happened to you in your life that brought you to the place of being a serial rapist. That's the only kind of closure I can get from this, understanding you as a human, flawed and broken. To the court, I would like to express my deep gratitude that the victims who came forward were taken seriously. What followed was sometimes flawed and definitely took a huge emotion. This is not something that will go away for me, nor should it go away for him. But it is my hope that we can both become more human again if he starts from a place of telling the truth and taking responsibility for his actions. Not in the way you do for a plea deal, but in the way he must if he wants his life to have any sort of value. It wasn't like anything that I think anyone expected to hear, and I worried that I would let people down by offering that level of compassion. But ultimately, I think that compassion is like the most important quality we can share with each other as humans, and I still feel that way after everything that's happened. So this experience, as hard as it was, as long as it was, and as disappointing as it was in times, has actually become really transformative. I think the beginning of it was that victim statement and reaching out with compassion, and then also allowing myself to be interviewed about it, to even write my own story about what happened. It's been really transformative. And again, I don't feel like I'm doing this for me. I feel like I'm doing this for every victim of sexual assault. And we're definitely having a watershed moment with regards to that. And I hope that to provide a story that has an element of hope with it.
Erica Doudreau lives in Bellingham. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're telling stories about personal space today on Sound Effect. When you are a big person, society seems to send these relentless messages that you take up too much space. So there's something really refreshing about feeling small. Well, one way to get that feeling is to appreciate the vastness of the world, the way you do on a good hike. But as Sound Effect contributor Bethany Denton explains, getting out into nature can be a challenge.
I think it can sometimes feel like there's no room for fat people in the outdoors. I say this as a fat person. In fact, a fat person who grew up in a very outdoorsy community outside of Glacier National Park in Montana. As a kid, I hiked and skied and rafted like most people do out there. But as I got older, and as I got fatter, hiking trips became less frequent. Mostly by choice, since I was almost always the slowest one holding up the rest of the group. But as a teenager, I often witnessed friends making plans for this hike or that backpacking trip. Plans peppered with different excuses as to why it was probably for the best that I didn't come along. You really need to be sure-footed for this trail. You know, stuff like that. After a while, even short hikes seemed out of my league. And so I would say things to my friends like, "Please, you think this hikes?" while gesturing to my body. We'd all laugh. And later I would imagine them on the trail, scaling the last 1,000 feet of elevation, the viewpoint in sight. I imagine their exhaustion, their sore muscles and sweaty backs, and their euphoria when they reached the top. I'm not going to speak for all fat people, but what I will say from my experience is that for me, the danger of being fat is not the physical limitations. The danger of being fat for me is the resignation. Thoughts that begin with, "I could never," or "I'm not the kind of person who could blank until I lose weight." And so I told myself for years that I hated the outdoors, all while daydreaming about how amazing it must be to be in the woods or up on a mountain, without judgment or fear of my body failing me. So when I discovered the group Fat Girls Hiking, you can imagine my excitement.
Is there, everyone's here?
Yes, I think so.
Everyone's here. Great. Fat Girls Hiking is a body positive outdoor community based in Portland, Oregon. So just like any type of movement-based activity that seems intimidating, we try to do together.
You use the word intimidating. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of fitness places are intimidating for fat people because, well, the motivation, I think, for a lot of people going to fitness places is weight loss. And that's not my motivation at all. For doing any type of movement, it's mostly mental health, and it just feels good.
My goal is never. Summer, the group's founder, started Fat Girls Hiking back in 2015. When I asked Summer how the group got started, she told me it began as a joke between her and her girlfriend at the time.
I was dating someone who would just like surprise me with hikes. She would just be like, "Let's go for a drive," and I'd be like, "Cool." And then we'd go for a drive, and she'd be like, "Hey, we're gonna walk to this waterfall," and I'd be like, "Okay." And then it would be like a 4-mile hike, and I'd be like, "I'm wearing fashion boots that like are not good for a wet trail." And then so one day we were on this trail, and we were just like, "God, everyone just felt like everyone was looking at us." Like, what are these fat girls doing hiking, you know? We were just, like, laughing about it, like, "Yeah, we're fat girls and we're hiking," you know? And we're just totally, like, making fun of ourselves. And then it just became a thing. I just started an Instagram, and it was just like, yeah, that's how it started.
There is one rule in fat girls hiking. No one gets left behind.
It makes me so mad when I hear that people go on group hikes and they get left behind. But that's the common experience, right? You have to be able to keep up or you'll get left behind. That's how it's always been, you know? Like, when you're in school and you have to, like, run the mile. I was always the last person. I loved running. But I got so shamed for being the last person that I stopped doing it because it wasn't fun to feel like shit about being the last person.
I met up with Summer and a group of other fat girl hikers on a typical December morning. There were 7 of us that day. 9, if you count the 2 dogs on leashes. We met at Karkeek Park in northwestern Seattle. The sky was overcast and gray all day. The trails were muddy with recent rains, and the salty smell of the Puget Sound was heavy in the air. Our only goal was to make it to the beach.
Here, and that's our trail right there.
Okay. And as happens in groups of people with similar bodies, we talked about our bodies.
Has anyone here ever had trouble buying outdoor or athletic clothes?
Oh, yeah.
It's impossible to buy athletic clothes as a larger woman. They don't make them.
This is one hiker, Marley Blonsky.
It's really, really frustrating. Like, for example, right now I'm wearing Target yoga pants, which are really not functional for hiking. It's just, we need functional clothing. Like, we hike, we bike, make clothes for us. We'll buy them.
Yeah. We eventually came to a trestle that crossed a train track and led down to the beach. A murder of crows danced happily above us, and the sky glowed that strange yellow-gray that happens when the sun is behind thick layers of clouds. As we walked, another hiker, LaMonica Washington, told me about a time when she went to a snowshoeing class with a friend. Before the class even started, LaMonica and her friend both noticed other people in the class staring at her.
You know, it was just kind of a weird experience. Even my friend, he's a tall, thin, white guy, even he sensed that people were, like, prejudging me. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if he can sense that, then you know something's there. He was like, I just don't understand why everybody's looking at you. I don't think it's because you're black. It's because he was like, there's two black guys here and a lot of Asian people here. I just don't understand. And I was like, well, you got to look around again. I'm the fattest person here. Everyone else here is, you know.
Yeah.
It's eye-opening, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When they can see you actually being, like, stereotyped mm-hmm. without even knowing your drive, you know, your goals or, you know, your ambition, you know, assuming that you have no business being here. Mm-hmm.
I know that look that LaMonica is talking about. All of us fat girl hikers do. There's something happening with fat people online, especially on Instagram, which is where I discovered fat girls hiking in the first place. I keep seeing profiles of fat people living life without trying to lose weight. There's this idea that being fat doesn't mean you're not healthy, just as being thin doesn't mean that you are. And it might seem like a small thing, just deciding to be fat, an inaction rather than an action. But for me and for other fat girls hiking, deciding to live a healthy life that doesn't center around weight loss is revolutionary.
Because I think a lot of people say this, I've heard this a lot through fat girls hiking, like, oh, well, I'll do that hike when I lose this amount of weight. And I'm just like, why have that be a barrier for yourself? Why not just do it now? And it's like a freedom to, like, have all this space. I can kind of take up as much space as I want. Being around, like, you see, like, a huge tree, you're like, no one's, like, shaming this huge tree for being big. This tree is beautiful because it's big. And thinking about things like, no, you're actually really insignificant in the world. When you are next to the ocean, you just realize how small you are. And that's just, like, to me, that's, like, that kind of perspective is the most beneficial thing.
Near the end of the group hike, I started talking to Kelsey Esquinas.
For me to, like, experience nature and its grandeur is, like, more healing or, like, more valuable to my life than the actual fitness part.
Yeah.
So there's this song that kind of, I think, like, encompasses it. It's by Kimya Dawson. Do you know who that is? It's called I Like Giants. It basically says, like, you're smaller than a speck of dust in a giant's eye. And I feel like when you go to the mountains or, like, when you see that type of stuff, like, that is so visually representative.
I'm getting a little emotional because that's one of my favorite songs.
That's, like, awesome. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. And it's not really a very common.
We all packed up and met each other out for lunch at a Central American restaurant. No one said anything about calories or bad foods. Plates were passed around. We all tried each other's meals. And Kelsey gave me a ride home, and along the way, she switched on Kimya Dawson, and we both sang along to one of our favorite songs.
I am one with everything. Rock and roll is fun, but if you ever hear someone say you are huge, look at the moon, look at the stars, look at the sun, look at the ocean and the desert and the mountains and the sky, because all girls feel too big sometimes, regardless of their size. Say I am just a speck of dust inside a giant's eye.
Bethany Denton lives in Seattle, where she helps produce the podcast Here Be Monsters. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, our theme is personal space. It's hard to think of a more personal, private space than the very last one we occupy on Earth. Death can be quick, but it can also creep along, getting closer with each day. Most of us would never think of entering the room of a stranger who's in the final stages of dying, unless you're a caregiver or a loved one. But all over the country, there are groups of singers who do exactly that. They're called threshold singers, and they perform these private little concerts in hospital and hospice rooms to try and bring some peace to the dying. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing spent time with the Threshold Singers of South Puget Sound.
Five older women sit in a circle, preparing to make their rounds. We are at Franciscan Hospice in Faircrest, Washington, just south of Tacoma. These women aren't doctors. They're not nurses or physical therapists. They are here to sing.
You are not alone. We are here to...
Our point here is not to get people enthusiastic and clapping and stomping their feet, but actually the reverse of that. These are like adult lullabies. My name is Jack Schultz, and I'm currently the administrative director for the South Sound Threshold Singers. We hope that this will help people be less agitated, that will help calm them down, they won't be so fidgety, and they'll be able to find peace.
To make sure they don't surprise anyone, someone scouts out the rooms ahead of time to see if the hospice patients and whoever else is in the room with the patient are up for a visit from these complete strangers.
My name is Rosemary Penio. It always feels like such a privilege to be invited in. And if we knock on the door and we say we're here, you know, and they invite us in, it just feels like such sacred space to be part of for those few minutes we're there.
On this day, a few patients say they don't want any visitors, but four patients or their loved ones say, sure, stop on by. Before going into the first room, the singers make a stop at the water fountain.
We're just hydrating before we get started, because water is very important for a singer's voice.
These women quietly file into room number 3 and surround the hospital bed. The patient's daughter sits by the window, looking over her mother. Her mom's name is Catherine. Catherine is a wisp of what she was when she was healthy. She is curled up in her bed in a fetal position. She's just shy of 80, and she's dying of colon cancer. Even though her eyes are closed, one of the singers, Paula Foreman, gives Catherine a gentle greeting, explaining why there is this sudden group of people in her room, and tells her what they're about to do.
A few peaceful songs for you while you rest. And you don't need to do a thing except just lie there and rest.
Easy, rest easy. Let every trouble drift away.
All of the songs sung by the Threshold Singers were written with this specific audience in mind, the dying. The songs are short. They ride that line between being spiritual yet secular. Rosemary Pinio, who we met earlier, says that the act of singing is a way to touch the dying without laying any hands on them.
The power of the human voice is amazing, and it touches people on a vibrational level, and it's live, and it's so different from recorded music, because we can't adjust to the tempo, we can't adjust to the softness, we can see whether what we're singing, we can change songs if we need to, if that song is not having the desired effect. It just sounds different, feels different, and we hope it touches people the way we are touched. And it's healing for us too. It always feels like that vibration inside our bodies heals us as much as it heals the family and patients.
Every singer in this group has lost someone they love. They find great purpose in this singing, in providing comfort and making death less scary. We visit a few more rooms, and then we file into room number 17. A daughter and her sister-in-law sit by the bedside of their mother, Clarissa.
Hello, Carissa. My name is Paula, and I'm here with a small group of singers. And we're hoping we can just sing some gentle songs for you, and all you need to do is just rest. And we'll bathe you with song.
Clarissa's hair is long and silver. Her dry lips are parted open. Most of her teeth are gone. She stares at the ceiling, but I don't see her blink. And if it wasn't for the shallow rise and fall of her chest, you would think that Clarissa was already gone. The two family members make room for the singers.
Lay down your burden, let go. Lay down your burden, let go. You are pure love now, you are pure grace. Lay down your burden, let go.
Clarissa, who was completely still just a second ago, starts to gasp for air. Her breathing is rattled. It's difficult to watch. Her loved ones standing in the corner start crying. Is the music causing this woman pain? Clarissa's daughter, Kathleen, doesn't think so. She sees her mother's response as a step closer to an end of her mother's suffering.
She's pretty quiet all day long. She was pretty calm and peaceful. And I think that helped her.
Yes, it helped.
I think it helped her.
Her mom's decline has been long. Strokes, dementia, infections.
She's just been holding on. And I think that's gonna help her be able to release and to go on her next journey. We'll see. That she's calm. She's peaceful.
3 days later, Clarissa finally lets go.
That was Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Janae Janik, Bethany Denton, Kyle Norris, Hayat Norimine, Simone Alisea, Cordelia Ridley, and Aaron Hennessy. Matt Martinez is our executive producer. Make sure to go subscribe to our podcast, which you can find on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, or wherever else you get your audio. You can also play us on your smart speaker by saying, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." And we love to get your feedback. You can rate and review us on iTunes or send email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when the theme is Benefit of Hindsight. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.